Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. This is Ronnie Martin, and I'm joined with none other than Barnabas Pipe Piper for this special edition of The Rant. Special edition because Big T is out of town, and I'm going to be having a discussion with Pipe about a few things, about his background in the family Piper and what life looked like as a PK all those years ago. Maybe how it affects him today. But Pipe, we as we always do, we have some business to attend to. So why don't you use your expert promotional skills to say great things on behalf of those who pay us great money to say those great things?
They pay us money, whether or not it's great.
I just like saying the word great that many times.
Yes, no, it's true. Big thanks to Waterbrook Multnomah for sponsoring the podcast again. The title they are highlighting is a book called Known, Finding Deep Friendships in a Shallow World. It is by a husband-wife co-author, Dick and Ruth Foth. I don't really know how to say their last name, which means I feel like I'm doing them a disservice. But so they've spent a long time doing counseling and teaching, mentoring, things like that. And the whole premise of the book is, and it scratches at something we've actually talked about on the show before, is kind of the nature of friendships and finding genuine, deep relationships in a world built around digital connections and transience and how fast everything is moving. And so questions like, is it possible? What does it look like? What does a genuine friendship look like in a world like this? And built around the idea and the model of Christ's friendships with different people. So his disciples, the group of women that followed him, those closer friendships that he had even within the disciples. So again, the book is Known, Finding Deep Friendships in a Shallow World by Dick and Ruth Foth. And we'll drop a link to it in our show notes. So if you just go to happyrantpodcast.com, you can find it there. It is available wherever books are sold. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Lifeway, Christian book distributors, Mardell stores, Books a Million. I can keep going. There's probably only like three more bookstore chains in existence at this point. So again, Known, Finding Deep Friendships in a Shallow World, coming from Waterbrook Multnomah, available now. Go get your copy.
Pipe, how do you spell the last name? I'm just curious.
F-O-T-H.
I mean, I like Foth.
Foth is what I would guess.
Yeah.
But in this day and age, I feel like people can just pronounce things however they want.
Right. So there's no right or wrong. It's just whatever we want their last name to be.
Let's go with Foth. I feel like that's the safest guess. I certainly don't want to. I don't want to get it wrong, but there is no wrong. So Dick and Ruth Foth.
And you know what? When you're on Amazon and you're punching in F-O-T-H, it really doesn't matter how you pronounce a name.
That's true.
That you get to the book and click proceed to checkout.
Yeah, just put the letters in proper order, F-O-T-H, you'll find it.
Absolutely. Well, Pipe, I'm excited to talk to you today as card-carrying members, if there is such a thing, of this, this reformed theological tribe that we simultaneously poke fun at and are a part of. There's always going to be some measure of interest in your status. And of course, by status, I mean status as the son of one John Piper.
But mainly as the co-host of this podcast.
Mainly as the co-host of this podcast. But you do have that secondary title, which would be son of John and Noel Piper. And of course, we know John Piper as being, I don't even know how to describe him, the modern reformed movement's incarnation of Jonathan Edwards. Would he like that? Would he appreciate that description right there?
I appreciate it, probably. He would probably deflect it because Edwards is, his greatest theological influence. I don't know if hero is the word that he would use, but, if he has a hero, it would be Edwards. But then he's got a little bit more of the dramatic flair than Edwards did, too. Like, Edwards was a theologian, thinker, writer who is known to be a fairly I don't know what the word is, dry preacher.
Exactly.
Whereas my dad is a writer for sure, but is known to be a bit of a video game character in the pulpit.
Yeah, there's some right that when you watch JP, there's a little drama going on in the pulpit. I mean, yeah, nobody denies that. Yeah,
yeah, it always sort of starts off with that. You know, he kind of has this voice when he starts, and then all of a sudden, you know, 4 minutes in, it's something explodes.
Yeah, he just goes.
The rocket takes off. It's like countdown, and then.
I had a guy tell me the other day too. A guy close to our ministry, and he said he you know, he's kind of a recent JP fan. And, you know, kind of become a little bit of a fanboy listening to podcasts and all that good stuff. But he was kind of struck at your dad's sort of this idea that when he starts sermons and there's not – he doesn't do the typical, you know, let me tell the funny story. Let me just sort of get into everything slowly. He just immediately like opens the word, reads, and then bam, he's like right into it. Like he doesn't mess around.
Yeah, and if it's a sermon, so when he was a pastor, he retired in 2013 from the pastorate. I always need to clarify and say retired from the pastorate, because anybody who is not super familiar might think that actually means retired, and that's anathema to him.
Yeah.
So when he retired from being a full-time pastor at a church, when he preached for 33 years at Bethlehem. Yeah, he would just dive right into the text, and he would just sort of like – because everything followed the sermon before with rare exception. You know, he preached through like 1st and 2nd Corinthians, 1st and 2nd Peter, Romans. Yeah. Romans took like 9 years, literally. That's not an exaggeration.
Yeah, it literally was your childhood, like you said a few weeks
ago. Yeah, it was my entire adolescence and college life. And so, yeah, he just would just sort of pick up and go. And then when he preaches at a conference, you know, so it's just a one-off kind of thing, he just sort of he jumps up there and he lays out the premise, you know, this is my working premise. There's the text, and then we hit the gas and go. Yeah, there's no like. So I was talking to my friend Steve the other day, and Steve had this thing to say, and it made me think about this. And then there's this pithy, you know, a pithy
Opening
joke.
Opening it up like it's a comedy routine.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like
no. He
central special. You know.
He can be very funny, but it's always by accident. He's not. He's not a comedic person.
And there's no planned humor in his sermons.
Oh, he would not do that if he tried. And I mean, and that's not a shot at him. I say these are all things that he would say. I think he scoffs at humor from the pulpit, in a contrived way.
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I think one of the things that our listeners will be fascinated by is just some of the insight that you might be able to give them and us into what it was like growing up a little bit as son of John, as well as being a pastor's kid in general. But I want to start by asking the obvious question: What was it and is it hard being the son of a guy like John Piper?
Yes and no. I think it's a situation where there are certainly. There's certainly greater expectations. There are certainly, you know, there's a bit more of a magnifying glass on things that I do. It does not help any that I have chosen to live a life in the same sphere that he has great influence in. So I've worked in, I went to the same college that he went to, and then I moved straight into Christian publishing, and I've been part of the conservative evangelical world for my entire life. With a few breaks, but very few, and so that means that I'm perpetually around people who, when they meet me, they say Piper, any relation to, and then they trail off, and then I have to fill in, yes, John is my dad, and so there's just that sense of expectations that come with awareness, and I think any pastor's kid feels that on a sliding scale to whatever place they are known. But is it difficult? Not anymore. It's just it's become a thing that I'm pretty adept and comfortable navigating. I think it creates some significant advantages too. Like when I hear authors who talk about how hard it was to get published, I'm like, huh, I didn't have that problem. And so I know that there's sort of a privilege that comes with it as well. It gets me in places that I would not otherwise get. Now, I feel an obligation to earn the right to be a place once I've gotten there. So my last name might have gotten me published, but I have to write a good enough book that it'll sell, or a good enough book that they would want me to write another one. And so there's that aspect of it. The times that it's the most frustrating are when people hold me to a standard based on who he is instead of who I am. No doubt. That can get really frustrating because it's just, you know, it's hard to kind of find a place to just sort of be at ease and be myself and not have people be like, well, what would your dad think? Or I'm so surprised John Piper's son talks like this or thinks like this or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, are those – so would those be the times where it's kind of hard to shrug it off, you know?
It's weird. Sometimes it's – I mean, I'd say 98% of the time, it's just sort of water off a duck's back. But there's those random tweets where I say something – I'll tweet something, a joke or something pretty heartfelt. And somebody will come back and go, well, what does your dad think about this?
Right.
And there's just like this boiling thing inside me that just wants to light them up like a Christmas tree, which is says more about me than them probably. But sometimes it really gets under my skin.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
The flip side of that is how gratifying it is when people come up and say things. You know, I've worked with them for a little while, or I've gotten to know them at church, and they're like, you know, when I heard you were John Piper's son, I was kind of like, eh. I don't know. Like, I don't know if I can be friends with this guy. And, you know, you're not anything like I expected. You know, more easygoing, better sense of humor, whatever it is. They just sort of – they see him as this sort of really serious figure. And so they assumed that I would be no fun. And I set their mind at ease apparently.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, here's a question. So were you aware of your dad's influence at a young age, or was it just – life with dad, you know? So people that have dads that have a little bit more of an influence than you know, the average person's parents, you know, sometimes to the outside world, you know, people look at their kids and think, oh, what must it be like? When in essence, you know, to you, he's just dad. Was it more like that?
Life at home, he was just dad. Like, he never carries himself like he's famous. And he certainly didn't. You know, nobody in my home would have put up with that anyway. You know, a famous person is never less respected than in their own home.
Yeah,
in both healthy ways and occasionally not healthy ways. But none of us were impressed with my dad's status. So when I say us, I have three older brothers, I have a younger sister, and then obviously my mom. He was just dad at home, and that was a good thing. In terms of awareness of his influence, a lot of that just comes with age and maturity and being aware of a circle that's bigger than your own immediate life anyway. So I was aware of his place in the church for as long as I can remember, you know, just because literally everybody at our church knew who I was when I was little, because it was a smaller church, well, smaller than it became. So it was, you know, 300-400 people when I was in early elementary school, and that just sort of grew steadily over the years. And so I knew that he was a kind of a big fish in that pond. But then, like, middle school, high school is where I started to realize, oh, people know who he is. Like, there's a pastor's conference that we host, and hundreds of pastors come from around the country because it's hosted by him. Right. And you know, they got really good speakers there too. But and then it was just sort of normal, you know, once or twice a year to have a box of books show up. That was his newest publication. So, like, I remember, I think the first one that I really remember was Future Grace. I think it was the first one that's, like, I just remember opening it up on the kitchen table. And that was kind of the one that stood out to me as, like, my dad writes books, you know? Right. Like, I knew he did that before because that was, I don't know, that was like a 7th or 12th book. I can't keep track. But then just... even that was just sort of a part of life, and it wasn't until really later high school and college that I realized, like, he's nationally known in this particular camp.
Yeah, it's funny that it took that long for it to sort of, you know, descend upon you and give you that sort of realization. That kind of leads me to another question, though. I mean, people probably wonder about, you know, the theological icons that must have stepped through the door of the Piper household. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
your dad keeps company with all of these pillars of, you know, of you know, modern church culture and of our tribe and what have you. Any people, any stories that stick out about dudes that walk through the doors and you had to spend the night with them, eat dinner with them, you know, those types of things?
Yeah, I mean, so the the most regular, consistent time when prominent, you know, preachers, theologians would be at our place was the pastor's conference. So growing, I think the pastor's conference started late 80s, 89, something like that.
Oh, wow. I didn't know it was that. I didn't know it'd been going that long. Wow.
It was really small then. You know, okay. it was much more regional thing. Now it was, you know, that was before Desiring God as a ministry even existed. Yeah. So it was just hosted by the church, you know, so it was like the church admins were kind of helping, and it was a lot very volunteer-based and small. But for the first probably 15 years of that conference, give or take. It's a Monday night, all day Tuesday, most of the day Wednesday, and then people ship out, just kind of like your typical pastor's conference schedule. Every Tuesday night, my mom would host dinner for the speakers, for whatever volunteer was hosting them, so sort of, you know, driving them around, getting them to and from, and then if they brought spouses or family with them. We had kind of the who's who of Reformed Christianity just sort of coming through our place. And my mom's way of hosting is a very sort of family style, make yourself at home. She's not a formal hostess.
Right.
It's easy to be there kind of hostess. So like grab a seat wherever you want. We've got drinks on the table, you know, just sort of like that kind of thing. And so it was usually like a massive urn of like soup or stew or like homemade bread and just sort of something really simple that you can feed 30 people with.
Yeah.
John MacArthur, J.I. Packer, R.C. Sproul, like, you know, George Verwer, like, I don't know, just they were all there. And I remember most of them just being pretty boring. Yeah. that was my impression as a kid. There was a handful who stood out. So the guy who founded Frontiers Missions, Greg Livingstone, was always awesome to have over because he came back multiple times because they always had a mission focused speaker, and for a while he was maybe every 2 or 3 years, and he would make bets with me and my brother, the one just older than me, to see if we could name a country he had not been to. And then he said, I'll give you $1 for every country you can name I haven't been to. And so it was sort of like a geography quiz for us and also kind of just a fun interaction. And he didn't realize that, like, we had a world map hanging in our dining room. We were sort of geography fiends. And so he ended up owing us like $30 and over the course of a few years. But he would bring it in like yen and rupees.
Nice.
And pesos, which means he probably paid us 72 cents.
Yeah.
But it was like a pile of foreign currency. So that was kind of fun.
And more importantly, gambling was not frowned upon in the Piper household. I think that's the big takeaway.
Well, it was a much more reward-based system than it was gambling, because it wasn't a system where, like, we would not have lost anything. It wasn't like we owed him $1 if we guessed wrong, you know, or something like that. No double or nothing, none of those kinds of things. I have very few memories of, like, I was never in awe of the people. It was mainly just, like, be polite, and I just mainly remember, like, they have boring conversations and most of them don't talk to me.
And this was kind of – it's fair to say too. I mean, this was way before the era of these guys becoming like bona fide celebrities and having a culture surrounding them that really propped them up the way in recent years that they've been sort of put on these pedestals. I mean, these were guys that were just pastoring churches, or they had parachurch ministries like R.C. Sproul did all those years with Ligonier, and they're just coming in to speak. So
Sproul, MacArthur, Packer, they were big in that generation.
I guess that's true. They were.
I mean, because you talk about, like, Packer wrote Knowing God in, what, the 70s?
Yeah, yeah.
That was a book that influenced – it influenced the generation of Reformed leaders who influenced the current generation of Reformed leaders. So, like, Packer was the influencer of Piper, who is the influencer of, like, Chandler. And so, in just sort of generationally speaking, and in writing, because he was writing a Reformed theology when nobody else was doing that.
Well,
and
that's
Sproul,
my point. So is Packer really as Packer as he is right now, though, when you go back 30 years or 25 years. I mean, did he carry the, you know, when you say Packer now, everybody goes, oh, Packer. I mean, was he Packer like that? Like,
I think he was, and maybe more so. Again, you're calling on recollections of like an 11 and 12 year old,
right,
which
exactly.
Means my qualifications at that age for who was cool were really different would they be any different now?
Right. So it's
yeah. I mean, it would be the exact same now. Actually, I'd still go in and be like, "Hey, nobody talks to me, and they're all really boring." But Packer has been exactly the same for 30 years.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
He is the same steady Canadian. You know, he has a dry wit, but it's like you got to listen real close. And you know, MacArthur's been MacArthur, and I don't remember Sproul much. But like, yeah, I mean, Paul Tripp, and in more recent years, and just different guys like that. Now they've done away with the Tuesday evening dinner at my parents' house, just because the conference is really big, so they do like a sort of a catered thing at the venue. But and I've been to that once or twice, and it feels much more like a, you know, it almost feels like a. Like it's like a hosted, almost like a fundraiser kind of dinner, even though they're not fundraising. And so, yeah, it didn't dawn on me till later that was a really unusual thing to have happen.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like when we did the episode a little while ago about all the music stuff, and you're just like, oh, I shared the stage with this guy, and I talked to this guy. Like, in some people's minds, that's like it bends their brains.
Right.
You know the guys from Audio Adrenaline and Newsboys and DC Talk, and you're like, yeah, we were coworkers in a sense, or like we crossed paths.
Right.
And that was a similar kind of feeling to me. And part of the reason why I have no awe whatsoever of Christian celebrities.
Yeah, I know. And I think that's, I think you just really summed it up really nicely. It's just, it's whatever is familiar to you and whatever becomes your standard and your normal, you know, it's, yeah, it's hard for it to become something more than what it actually is. But you know, I want to switch gears here and talk a little bit about, your book, Pipe. You wrote mm-hmm. a book called The Pastor's Kid. Man, and obviously, you know, I don't know that anybody could think of a better guy to write this book. I mean, of course, there's many other pastors' kids, but given who your dad is in this particular day and age, the influence that he's had, why don't you give the listeners, give our listeners, our faithful Happy Rant listeners, some insight into what was behind that? Why did you write it? What was at stake writing a book like that for you?
Yeah, the why I wrote it, that's... It's not a thing that I was like stewing on for a long time. And so it didn't come from this place of like it boiled over out of me all of a sudden, okay. You know, after years of sort of thinking on it. I guess I had been preparing to write it for a long time without realizing it. No, when I was in 2010, I went through a real significant time of I'll call it a faith crisis, not in the sense of like questioning it, does God exist and things like that, but just a profound experience due to my own failures and just being confronted with the gap between all the things that I knew and what my life looked like, and trying to sort out what are the things that I really believe, which I think is a question that pastors' kids in general are either terrified to confront or they confront it on a daily basis. Because all of us know what we're supposed to believe. The answers are really apparent. You know, it's every Sunday in the pulpit. All the moral expectations are there. The theological expectations are there. It's all right there in front of us. And so 2010, that I would have been, so I was mid 20s. Is that right? Yeah, mid to late 20s. And so this wasn't like a teenage adolescent thing. Like I was married, I had kids.
Yeah.
So this was an adult thing. And out of that came the realization that a lot of my faith struggles or the things that I was having trouble kind of owning and finding an identity in Christ stemmed from experiences as a pastor's kid. So that's not to blame my parents and it's not to blame the church, because I am still an active participant in church. I love my parents and I am a supporter of pastors. So this is, you know, it wasn't a, oh, they're at fault. It was just my upbringing created these challenges. Yeah. And so I just started kind of journaling, reflecting, jotting down completely disorganized thoughts as they would come to me. And then somewhere 2011, 2012, maybe, I got asked to write a couple articles, one for Gospel Coalition and one for Table Talk. the Ligonier's magazine. And I had started blogging maybe a year before that, and so they had picked up some of my writing and said, you know, they thought I could be a helpful voice. And so the one for Table Talk was the one that really tipped things for me, because I was flying to a conference in Austin where I was going to go work. I was working for a publishing company, and so I was like, oh, I'll use my 2 or 3 hours on the plane to just sketch out a rough draft of this article. And the article was just how to pray for pastors' kids. They have a highlight section in their magazine about to help church members know how to pray for ministry families. It was a 900 word article, and I was like 120 words in, and all of a sudden I just broke down crying on the airplane, you know, like hiding in the window seat, hoping that the person next to me was sound enough asleep and their noise canceling headphones were really, really noise canceling. I mean, I wasn't sobbing, but like tears are coming down my face, and just realizing that to write that had ripped the lid off of something.
Yeah.
And so I got that article out, and I got the Gospel Coalition one out, and then I started to see all the responses come in.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it was from two groups of people. It was pastors' kids, some of whom were like 55-year-old women, but they still see themselves as pastors' kids. You know, my dad was a pastor, and I have struggled with X for 40 years. Wow. And others who were 16, and they're like, you know, I'm at odds. I'm at loggerheads with my parents right now. And then the other was younger pastors. Or pastors with kids still at home, really, saying, this really helped me see things that I ought to be doing differently with my kids, or it opened up the door to have a conversation with my kids. And all of a sudden I realized, like, it didn't just rip a lid off for me. This touched a nerve with a lot of people. And so I just started, again, just sort of taking those thoughts that I had written down, writing down more, organizing it as well as I could, and realizing, there's a lot here. Maybe I should write something longer. Prior to that, I had never considered writing a book. I had no intention of writing a book. I didn't set out to write books. It wasn't a goal of mine. And so then what I did was I put together probably a 15-20 question survey, pretty open-ended questions, and sent it to 40 or 50 pastors' kids. So younger, older men, women, different denominations. Some of them had pastors who were mothers. Some of them, you know, some of them were much more traditional, kind of all over the map, literally and figuratively, just to see the thing that I needed to know is my experience similar to theirs?
Yeah.
Because my dad is not like other pastors in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I felt like my experience might be really similar in significant ways as well. And out of those, you know, I probably got 30 or 40 of those surveys back. And there was only one person out of all of those who was like, I don't know what you're talking about. My life was fine. Everybody else highlighted particular areas of struggle, which you know, so struggles of faith, struggles of expectation, struggles of people demanding things of them or expecting certain, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so that was the kind of the clincher for me that, okay, this is a thing that can be written into a book. And so I put together a book proposal. I took it to 3 or 4 publishers, one of whom I decided not to go with, one of whom turned me down, and the third offered me the book deal. And so so I wrote The Pastor's Kid, and it came out – so I guess I wrote it in 2012, 2013, and then it came out summer of 2014.
Yeah. I mean, I think you said a couple of significant things, and one of the things that kind of strikes me is that, you know, given your role, given the position that you are in, given that you're not you're a long ways away from being a kid, you know, I mean, that was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Your growing up years are way behind you, and but nevertheless, there was still like a battle that you had to engage your mind in, you know, in terms of how the past is maybe still informing, you know, the present for you. And it seems like that's something that PKs, they have to engage in. They have to step in, instead of just kind of swimming on the surface or trying to find ways in which they can say, look, I'm not having anything to do with any of that because of my upbringing and my childhood. And it sounds like you just said, well, look, I gotta work this out because I don't want to just simply walk away. I don't want to simply just become a victim in this. So my question to you is this. What do you say to kids, especially PKs, or even just kids that had parents that just gave themselves a ministry, you know, a ministry of any kind? What do you say to kids who simply try to run as far as they can the other way? I mean, what do you say to kids like that? Kids, adults, you know, people that have that path.
Yeah, people who were kids in that context.
Exactly.
Well, first, I completely understand the desire. Maybe it's a temptation. That's probably a better word for it. To just split. Now, I think you can distance yourself from the ministry without distancing yourself from the faith. There's a lot of people who do that. You know, so they are faithful to Christ, but they find their joy in another field. And you know, their God has given them gifts and art or business or music or whatever. And I think that's great. That's not exactly the same thing though, because that's not a rejection or a rebellion. It's finding one's own path in a way that is honoring to God. And I think that's really good. I think people who are inclined to flee, to split, to not deal with the issues, or to just cut and run, running never takes you anywhere. Because there's no destination.
Yeah.
And you're still being driven by the thing you're trying to escape, because the only direction you have is away from that thing. So it's a life of avoidance instead of a life of direction. So you're marked by all the stuff you don't want to be, instead of being marked by a sense of progress, a sense of identity, a sense of direction. You will end up becoming more miserable unless you find a way to arrive somewhere, or to find a road that takes you somewhere. So the subtitle of my book is Finding Your Own Faith and Identity, because those are the things that are directional. It is your relationship with Christ. It is your identity in Christ. It is, you know, not your parents, not your backgrounds, not your denominations, not the expectations. None of those things matter for you. And so if you're fleeing, you're not finding anything. You're just avoiding things. And so that would be just sort of my first statement.
Yeah.
Or first thought to them is, where are you going? What do you hope to accomplish? That's like a child throwing a temper tantrum, except in grown-up form.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. You know, because it's what you're describing is that there's a sense where you're fighting the wrong battle. You're not really engaging in the battle that actually needs to be fought, is what it sounds like you're saying.
You're not engaging in anything. You're fleeing. I mean, it's life on the run instead of life facing the things. Now, facing the difficulties of a childhood in ministry, it can be profoundly difficult. But usually if you don't face it, the difficulties become greater, as opposed to just, doing the necessary things to figure out. And I'm speaking vaguely because there's not a formula. Doing the necessary things to figure out negative feelings about the church or struggles to connect with Christ on a personal level. I think a lot of pastors' kids have trouble with that. This idea of a personal relationship with Christ is verbiage that we use all the time.
Yes.
But think about it. Personal relationship with Christ. Like that's a hard thing to just – you can't drum that up.
Yeah.
So especially not when it's the most familiar thing in the world to you and seems sort of rote and mundane.
Yeah, and I think that's really good, man, in terms of, you know – kind of what you alluded to there, which is, you know, these are people, you were a person that saw the good, the bad, and the ugly when it came to the church, right? So
yes.
One of the things that you probably even today have to do is guard against cynicism, discouragement, and because it's easy to let those things be sort of your reason to check out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have a tendency towards being contrarian and which lends itself to cynicism.
Yeah.
And the church is an easy target for me.
Yeah.
I can walk into any evangelical church be there for a Sunday, maybe two, and I could probably put my finger on 80% of the cultural issues that that church has. And I don't say that to brag. Yeah. That's just it's like a doctor. You can diagnose people by the symptoms after one or two visits 80% of the time. Unless it's a really random, weird, rare thing. And the church doesn't have a lot of really random, weird, rare things. It has the same stuff over and over and over again.
Right.
Which means that when I walk into a church, whether it's the church that I attend regularly or any other church, I have to try really hard to be part of it and not be evaluating it.
Yeah.
Because it's evaluation and observation is much, much easier. It's the lazy way out for me. But it's also the easiest way to become disenchanted. And so for me, one of the things that has helped tip is just to realize, and this is going to sound cliche, but a lot of times cliches exist for good reason. Is the familial aspect of church. It is, every church is a dysfunctional family, but if you are part of a family, unless it is an aggressively terrible situation, you remain committed to it.
Yeah.
You still see people. You still love people. You're still there for people. You still work through the stuff. You might fight like cats and dogs. Maybe we need a little bit more fighting in the church and a little bit less passive aggressive. I don't know.
Yeah.
But to think of it in those terms instead of organizational terms, because as an organization, churches are generally, they're pretty crappy.
Yeah. No, that's a really good way to put it. We're better for it. We're better for sticking it out. We're better for seeing what God might do because we have decided to stay committed. You know, it's funny too, is the way you describe going to other churches and you're able to sort of pull them apart, and it's hard not to be critical. I mean, you just described every pastor's issue, which is you go to another church and all you're doing is you're monitoring and you're observing and you're seeing everything happening of which you're saying, I can do that better. I'm seeing a big issue here. This thing feels a little tilted the wrong way. It's almost like it's hard for you to engage because all you see, you become very clinical about it very quickly.
And you listen to a sermon and you think how you would preach that text instead of appreciating and absorbing how that preacher preached the text. I fight that every Sunday. It is easy, and I've never been a vocational preacher, but I grew up under somebody who is considered by most to be a pretty profoundly good preacher, and I do a fair amount of speaking, and so between the two of those, I have a standard that I can't really help, and so I listen to a preacher, and my thought is always first, well, I don't know if I would have said it like that, and then I realize that that's not, that's the opposite of how one should be in a place of worship and in kind of in a stance of worship.
Yeah, the approach is a little bit off. But having said that, let's talk about this for 1 second. Where are you at? Like when you listen to, or if you even listen to your pops preach, I mean, is it hard for you to even listen to him as a preacher? Or do you, I mean, is he a go-to for you if you ever, want to grab a podcast and listen to a sermon? Or is it just somebody that you've heard so much you just can't even return to it?
I'll answer the second part first. The answer is no, he's not a go-to for me, but neither is anybody else. Okay. I don't listen to sermons on podcasts almost ever. Sometimes I will. There are times when I'm like, there's particularly spiritually dry times, or if I've heard that somebody preached a sermon on a text or on a topic that is something that I ought to listen to that I'd benefit from. But no, he's not a go-to for me. There's a couple reasons for that. The first is what you were talking about, which is I've heard my dad say so many words over my lifetime. If I want to hear words from my dad, I would rather either sit down across the table from him and have lunch or call him on the phone since we don't live in the same state. Just that – those are interactions that are better.
Yeah, it's called a conversation.
Yeah, and it's called a relationship.
Right.
I do not relate to my dad's preaching. That is – now – that's also the thing that has connected to hundreds of thousands of people. And so there are going to be people who hear me say this and they're going to think I'm a very jaded person. And I might be, But a lot of it is just, it's just a familiarity thing and a relational dynamic. It's not, you know, it's not a hatred of his preaching by any means.
Yeah.
The other thing is that I just, having been in the family of a celebrity preacher, I need to distance myself from podcast preaching, conference preaching. It's just funny because I'm at conferences, you know, seven times a year or something, but otherwise I don't enjoy going to church.
Yeah.
You know, I go to a smallish church with a pastor who preaches faithfully and he does a good job.
Yeah.
But he's not the world's best orator.
Right.
And so to go listen to people who are the world's best preachers, or, you know, you put that in quotes, but that does not help me appreciate a Sunday morning in East Nashville.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, and that is something that's been discussed when you can, when you have easy access to the guys that are, you know, gifted in the sense that they get a lot of downloads, you know, on a weekly basis, as opposed to, you know, 98% of everybody else who doesn't. But those are the guys people are attracted to because they have a way of communicating that has, you know, given them an audience for that. But let's lighten the mood, man, as we're kind of getting to the end of our podcast here. And let's talk about how about a story of a moment or two that sort of encapsulates your pastor kidness, some crazy stories that either people who weren't pastor kids are going to laugh at, and ones that are going to absolutely relate to.
Oh man, let's see. Well, I think the funniest story is, so this was, it wasn't when I was growing up. It was right when I moved away from home, literally the day I moved away from home. So I went to Wheaton College and drove down there in a minivan loaded up with all my stuff for my dorm room. And I arrive at Traber Dorm at Wheaton to move in for freshman year. And I walk into the lobby. You know, they have the sign in for new students, and they have the whole welcome, you know, sort of the student leaders who are there to welcome. And I sign in, and the girl who's signing me in, you know, she welcomes me. She says, "Oh, you're on floor 7. I'm on this floor. Our floors are like the brother sister floor thing that Wheaton does." And she's like, "Oh, and that guy over there," and she points to a guy sitting in a chair, kind of across the lobby, has been waiting for you.
Oh boy!
I look over. I don't recognize him. He's been waiting for you for 2 hours.
Wow!
Just sitting there. So he didn't even go to Wheaton. He was a guy from the community who found out that I was attending Wheaton and waited for 2 hours to help me move in. Wow. You know, like three suitcases or two suitcases and a couple boxes and a stereo, you know? And it was just because of my last name. And I just sort of remember going blank after that because, like, I don't remember him leaving.
Right.
I hope I was polite. I doubt I was. I'm sure my mom was polite though, and she was there.
Piper, so, it's like he still lives next door to you right now.
Yeah. Well, no, I know who he is now, and there was a bit of a family connection which I wasn't aware of at the time. You know, so sort of his parents knew my parents kind of thing, but like I had no idea, and it was just sort of. I had had this grand idea of leaving home and making my own way in the world and kind of escaping some of the expectations, and literally minute one on campus, there's somebody waiting for me. And then, you know, so I settle into the dorm, and it's like day two on campus, and I meet a couple people as one does freshman year. And so you decide who's going to be your best friends for the rest of your life, 48 hours into college. And so we walk on over to the dining hall to grab dinner during orientation week, and we walk inside, and somebody comes at a dead sprint up to me. "Are you John Piper's son?" Doesn't introduce himself.
Yeah.
Doesn't ask my name. Doesn't even know my name, I don't think. He just knows that I'm John Piper's son. And that was one where I have sort of half regret and half sort of smug smile. I just completely blew him off. I was just like, "Yep," and just walked past him.
Wow.
Mostly regret. That was kind of a douche move. But so like that was my first 48 hours having moved away from home. There was more than one occasion. There's one instance I remember. I think I wrote about this one in the book, but I was driving to like a Wednesday night youth group, I think it was, or a Sunday night youth thing, and my friend and I were driving two separate cars. And so we both peel into the church parking lot going, you know, 72 miles an hour. And listening to, I think I was listening to Linkin Park's Hybrid Theory.
Nice.
Because at 17, one does not have great taste in music. And he's listening to like Dr. Dre or something. I don't know. We're Sweet. Just, it's loud and it's, you know, profane
yeah.
and fun. And then we both sort of stroll into church.
Illinois too, by the way. So
what's that?
It's Illinois too. So carry on.
No, that was Minnesota.
Oh, Minnesota. Okay.
So yeah, where I was going on.
Okay.
Yeah. No, this was prior to that. This was when I was in high school.
Okay.
He just strolls into church right past this lady, and she literally collars me. She gets a finger inside the collar of my shirt and just roundly chastises me for my driving,
wow.
for my music choice, for the profanity of the lyrics, although I'm sure she couldn't hear the lyrics.
Did she really know who Linkin Park was? I mean, let's be honest.
She just knew that it was like
– it was bad.
You know, it could have been Skillet. She would have known that. She wouldn't have known the difference. And he was listening to Dr. Dre louder than I was listening to Linkin Park. And like, let's be honest, one of those is probably more aggressive than the other.
Far worse, yes.
Yeah. Better music, but you yeah. know, that's a separate podcast. And I mean, it's just that was just sort of a typical instance of the way that a pastor's kid can be held to a standard that's arbitrary and separate from everybody else, because she just didn't know him. She didn't know him. He'd been at the church for 7 or 8 years, and his family was faithful. You know, still attends the church, and he and I are still friends. And it's just he was not the he wasn't the pastor's kid, and she wasn't like a staff wife. It wasn't like one of my family right. friends. It was just like a lady at the church who was yeah. who thought that she had access to me in that way. I think the other story. This was just sort of a constant, was the way that like every Sunday school class, so from like probably first or second grade up through high school, you know, the teacher would be teaching and I would ask a question and there would just be silence, and then slowly like all the heads would turn and look at me.
Nice.
Because
it was inevitable, wasn't it?
My problem was that was both pressure and expectation, but also like a real ego boost. Because I love knowing all the answers and having an opinion on things.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody who listens to this podcast knows this.
No, we all know that.
There's and so
arguing with you right now.
Yeah, no, you're nodding in agreement. I can hear you. I can hear you nodding.
Right. You can hear my neck, right? Not making that nodding sound. Yeah.
And so it became like this sort of vicious cycle of I don't want to have to answer all the questions, but I love answering all the questions.
Right. Yeah. That's funny, man. That's fascinating. Well, Pipe, man, thanks for chatting with us on the special edition of The Rant. And man, I'm sure your book has really been helpful to a lot of people that have come from your background. It's The Pastor's Kid by, of course, our own Barnabas Piper. What house did that come out on? What publishing house?
That was David C. Cook.
David C. Cook. Yeah. So go grab a copy
Dave.
And go.
Right. Came from Dave.
Came from Dave. You can go to Amazon. You can go on any. Any of the outlets where we buy books these days, and you can grab it. So I encourage you to do so. So yeah, thanks, Pipe. And when we come back, it'll be the trio. We'll be back in all of our glory together. And we also will have some information about our live in Louisville podcast coming up this
like real
October.
Information. This is not a mythological event.
It's not mythological. It's actually happening. We got the details all nailed down. We don't want to talk about them quite yet, but they are forthcoming.
And it will be indeed.
We're pumped. So again, as we always do, we have wandered to and fro. Rachel the Held Evans.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. Resonate has helped us with our editing and mastering pretty much from the beginning of the podcast. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Mark and Jake do a fantastic and timely job with all sorts of podcast services. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast.
Want to learn more about God and His will for your life one verse at a time? I'm Quinice Petway, co-host of the Your Daily Bible Verse podcast. I'm inviting you to tune in and subscribe at lifeaudio.com.